right, so last time, I'm going to give you a couple of slides of review from last class and get you back up to speed. We've already lost some students, okay? We'll see what happens. I mentioned last time that we're going to be talking about electroanalytical chemistry for the first third or half of the semester. And we're going to be dealing with potentiometric systems, and I will only be covering potentiometric systems are simple, and we'll cover them in the next couple of classes. I also mentioned in reference to physical chemistry that a potentiometric system is based on a galvanic cell. It spontaneously produces a potential. You put two half cells together, you put an electrochemical cell together, and it produces a potential. We measure that potential, we can relate that to concentration, and we have an electroanalytical method, a method that is based on electrochemistry but allows us to make analytical measurements. Once we finish the potentiometric systems in the next couple of classes, we'll move on to voltammetric systems. Voltammetric systems involve electrolytic cells, and that is really looks the same as far as a physical chemistry experiment and setting up an electrochemical cell looks the same, but it doesn't operate the same. It does not spontaneously produce electricity. You must provide power in order to cause an electrochemical reaction to occur or to electrolyze the solution. And then you can measure the current caused by the oxidation or reduction reaction or that is consumed in the oxidation or reduction reaction. And we can determine concentration from that current. So they work on very different principles. One, in the potentiometric system, we are measuring potential, and we are relating that potential directly to concentration. In a voltammetric system, which encompasses a lot of different electroanalytical techniques, we are usually applying a voltage and measuring a current. Not always, but often. And we're going to relate the current to the amount of material that is being converted from one form to another, oxidized or reduced at the electrode surface. And I really need you to understand the difference between those two types of electroanalytical methods at a minimum, okay, as far as this course is concerned. We defined potentiometry a little more in detail, I guess, in last class, and we talked about determining concentrations by using potential or voltage, a galvanic cell. We said there was an indicator electrode and a reference electrode, so it's only a two-electrode system. And we said that the names of these electrodes are quite good in the sense that they tell you exactly what they're doing. One electrode is the indicator. It indicates the species of interest. The other electrode is the reference. It is the one at which our potential measurements are referenced to, and it is independent of the solution composition. We then went ahead and talked about the overall E for the cell. Okay, E for the cell is the indicator minus the reference. Two half cells, potential in each one, but it doesn't mean anything until you put them all together in a complete circuit. And in our convention, we get the E for the cell by subtracting the E for the indicator, subtracting the E for the reference from the E for the indicator. And we also had a non-ideal junction potential that we talked about as well. Then we said Nernst equation is the equation by which these E's are determined. And so if I'm interested in setting up an electrochemical cell, I'm going to have an E from the Nernst equation for the indicator portion of my cell, so my indicator half cell, and then I'm going to have an E from the for the reference portion, also determined by the Nernst equation. And of course, we talked about the E0, standard potential, standard conditions, atmospheric pressure, 25 degrees C, infinite dilution, so forth. We can get those from tables, standard reduction potentials. We have the gas constant, absolute temperature, the number of electrons in the process, the Faraday, 96,500 coulombs per mole, natural log of the ratio of the activity of reduced things, reduced the reduced form of the species, divided by the oxidized form of the species, and the brackets indicate molar activity. And then we went on, I guess, and talked about how that would apply to three systems, three reference electrodes. The normal hydrogen electrode, from the historical perspective, important, has an E0 of 0.00 volts. So it's the one electrode to which all things are referenced, but we don't use it anymore. And then we talked about the saturated calomel electrode, which is a good, very important electrode, but isn't used much anymore because of mercury, although for decades it was the reference electrode of choice. And then we said today everything is done with silver chloride. And so pretty much all reference electrodes are of the silver chloride type. And I couldn't really tell you the electrode I passed around last class. I couldn't really tell you. I'd have to tear it apart and analyze the amorphous substance in the bottom to determine whether that's silver or calomel. But they're exactly the same. We indicated that those two reference electrodes could be fabricated in the same way. The difference is we would put silver chloride in a silver chloride electrode. We would put mercurous chloride in a calomel electrode. And we have an outer filling solution. Of course, this is a reference electrode only. Okay, you may be familiar with combination electrodes or more familiar with combination electrodes, like is in pH measurements. But this you would need to couple with a pH electrode, okay, which we'll talk about later today. And we need those two electrodes to make a potentiometric measurement like a pH measurement. So that's sort of my quick and dirty review of last class. I think maybe I got to this point and said that when we put together our system, we're going to have two electrodes with a meter. I described to you a little bit about the meters. I described to you the fact that we use an electrometer in the laboratory typically, although a potentiometer is another device that has been used historically. And then I went on to describe indicator electrodes. So we've got our reference electrode portion already worked out. And now we've got to talk about indicator electrodes. The indicator electrode of the first kind. Now this is, I give you this nomenclature because this is the historical terminology that was used. You know, electrochemists, very, very systematic. They came up with an electrode and they said, this is the first kind of electrode, okay? And that was just a metallic electrode, an active metal, not gold, not platinum, okay, not some noble metal, but an active metal like silver, copper, etc. Okay, and you could just stick that that piece of metal into solution, connect it with a wire to one side of my electrometer, and have my salt bridge to my reference electrode, and connect the other side of the electrometer to the reference electrode, and I've got an electrochemical cell that will measure the ions of that active metal. So, and I told you the story about they gave me the cadmium rod when I was an undergraduate. And they said, here's a piece of cadmium, make an electrode out of it. And that's all you did, stick it in the solution, connect a wire to it. And that's the electrode of the first kind. Pretty lousy electrodes, okay? They don't work that well, but again, historically speaking, very important. And you could use them. If you had to measure high concentrations of silver, for example, that would work okay, right? The silver ion would react with or would set up a potential and would actually react a silver ion in solution with the silver wire or silver whatever it was, maybe earring, you know, often use that as an electrode, okay? And you could actually measure silver ions in that fashion. Not the same as the silver chloride reference electrode that we measured, and the E0 is one hint. Of course, the reaction is different. Make sure you understand that distinction as well. Now, Nernst equation, again, I showed you that if we take the, this part of the Nernst equation, RT over F, and then multiply by 2.303 LOG equals LN, right? So the conversion factor from base 10 log to natural log. Then we end up with 0.0591 as the factor that you may be familiar with in the Nernst equation, okay? So either one, either way you want to do it, nobody wants to bother using all these other numbers. They want to just quickly plug some number in. In the case of the silver, in the case of the silver ion system that I just showed you, I plugged in the E0. There's my 0.0591. It is a one electron system because we always write the reactions as reductions. Silver ion goes to silver metal. And silver metal as a solid, separate phase from the solution, we assign it an activity of 1, and that's what goes into the equation for the reduced form of the species. And then we put the concentration or activity, technically electrodes measure activity. So the silver ion, the oxidized form of the species, plugs in here. And so what we end up with is an equation where we know all of this stuff, okay? And we have our piece of silver wire, sticking in our solution, hooked up to our electrometer with our reference electrode and so forth, and we can met whatever potential develops at that silver wire, which is displayed on the electrometer, then we can relate that to the concentration of silver ion in the solution. It's inversely proportional based on this relationship here, the E to the concentration or activity of the silver ion. And that's how it works. Real simple. That'll work for cadmium, in the case of cadmium, the number is 2 here, N is equal to 2, and the E0 is something else. I don't know what the E0 is for Cd2 plus 2 electrons yields Cd metal, but you can look that up. And we can do it for any number of active metals, right? Anything that will undergo that type of an oxidation-reduction reaction. Now, is there a lot of oxidation and reduction going on? Not really. Okay, very few ions are being converted to the atoms at the electrode surface. But a potential is developed. Okay, an electrical potential is developed, and we do have a galvanic system, and we do have something that obeys the Nernst equation, and so we can use it for this type of measurement. All right, maybe. And this is a picture of it. I didn't show you this last time, right? This is not that exciting. But if we took the idea that we're going to make this electrochemical cell, we have our little beaker, and it's got some silver ions in it. We stick a silver wire in there as our indicator electrode. It's connected to what we called our electrometer. All right, we let the electricians use the voltmeters, and the chemists will use the electrometers. And a high input impedance meter. And then we have a reference electrode, like the one I handed around in class, on this side. Its potential doesn't change. We get a potential that develops on the meter, and we can measure silver ions. Not all that great, but we can do it. All right, now I guess we can break some new ground here. Under the same heading of metallic indicator electrodes. Now, I'm outlining these electrodes. I'm giving them to you under two sets of two organizational schemes. There was the electrode of the first kind, so obviously the next one is the electrode of the second kind. Okay, click right there. And then there's the electrode of the third kind. But we'll get to that. Now, the other scheme for, and a probably a more modern way of looking at these electrodes is to say, okay, we had a metallic, we have a category called metallic indicator electrodes. There are basically three types of metallic indicator electrodes, and electrode of the first kind, electrode of the second kind. Anyway, the second kind is also a metallic indicator electrode, but number two, it's the active metal in contact with a slightly soluble precipitate involving the metal cation. And that precipitate, okay, is going to be key to how this works. The electrode is going to respond to the anion. All right, now, the example I'm going to use, as is shown here on the slide, is the silver-silver chloride system. You say, wait a minute, you can't do that. That's the reference electrode. Oh, but I can do that. Remember we said that as very clever chemists, we took a system known as the silver-silver chloride system and we made it into a reference electrode. But now we're going to not use it as a reference electrode, we're going to use it as an indicator electrode. See, look, now, can you use both silver-silver chloride as a reference and as an indicator? Yeah, you could, actually. But the reference, the use of that half cell as a reference would mean that it would be housed inside of a glass tube like the one I showed you. Okay, it would be housed in a device like this, and all of the silver and chloride and all that stuff would be inside of this electrode, but it would be self-contained. It would have an opening at the bottom to contact it with the solution, but it would operate as a reference electrode. In the solution outside that we dip this into, the test solution, we could also use another silver-silver chloride system, if we wanted to measure chloride ions. Remember, it's going to respond to the anion. And that would be separate and distinct, although have to be used together with the reference electrode that we talked about. So I'm hoping you're not getting confused by this, but these are the classic systems we need to talk about, and we need to understand that when I want to make an indicator electrode, I can use a lot of different things, and silver chloride is one of them. So I have that reaction that we already talked about, and we know, and it has its E0. You should probably look that up, because I think I probably put down more than two different E0s in my slides. Maybe I should look it up. And we can make an indicator electrode out of this. The difference is, instead of just a piece of silver wire, like we had in the silver-silver ion system, we now have a piece of silver wire, but it has something coated on the surface of it. That is silver chloride coated on the surface of it. Remember, the silver and the silver and the silver chloride must be in intimate contact with one another because they're interconverting, right? If we have a reduction reaction, then the Ag, which actually is Ag plus, right? It has a plus one valence in silver chloride, is going to be reduced by gaining an electron. So gaining an electron, GER, G-E-R, GER, gain electron reduction. We met Leo last class. It will then form silver metal, which has a zero valence, Ag0. They've got to be in intimate contact, right? Because the silver ion is being converted to the silver metal. The reverse reaction can also occur. We can oxidize the silver metal to silver ion, but again, that's going to happen. And how's it going to happen? It's going to happen because they're touching one another. So I told you that I anodized my silver wire. If I'm going to make this electrode, I'm going to take a piece of silver wire, I'm going to make it the anode of an electrochemical cell, I'm going to stick it in a chloride solution, and what's going to happen is chloride ions are going to plate out on the surface of that silver wire, and I will have a silver chloride coating right on the surface of the silver. Well, silver chloride coated on silver is silver chloride in intimate contact with silver, and therefore they can interconvert silver metal, silver chloride, back and forth. Right? So that's what's going on with this electrode. I've got with my best drawing skills, I drew on the surface of this some kind of a squiggly looking stuff. So if you actually took a silver reference electrode apart or a silver indicator electrode, you'd look at them and you'd see it wouldn't be shiny silver, it would be anodized with a chloride coating on the surface of it. So we put that together, we got a system that will measure chloride ions. Maybe I should have drawn some chloride ions in the solution here, okay? So we've got some chloride ions. Now, let's see if I, okay, I did. I wrote this out for you last class. We know the reaction, we know it's E0, we know the Nernst equation. Everything's taken care of in the Nernst equation for us. But in this particular situation, we said it's a reduced species over oxidized species. So the reduced species are on the right-hand side of our reaction because we write the reaction as a reduction. And certainly silver's Ag0 is the reduced form of silver. And but it's a different, it's a separate phase. So we include that as an activity of one. So there's my one. Well, actually, no, it's going to be in the numerator. So there's going to be times one. I can multiply by one. So we also have the concentration of chloride, right, on the right-hand side of our reaction. So that's going to go in the numerator of this equation. And then in the denominator is our oxidized stuff. But the oxidized, well, we don't put the electron in there. The oxidized stuff is the silver chloride, which is also a separate phase. And we're also going to include that as an activity of one. So there's the one that I circled previously. So we said last time, when we talked about reference electrodes, that the Nernst equation, everything is all taken care of for us. And we find out that E is directly proportional to chloride concentration, but in the reference electrode, we fixed the chloride concentration. We made it constant, right? How do we make it constant? We threw in some saturated potassium chloride. And that meant that if chloride was used up to make silver chloride, then the potassium chloride released some more chloride and gave us a constant concentration of chloride. If chloride is produced by the reduction of AgCl to Ag metal, then the insoluble or the potassium chloride system would pick up that excess chloride and form some more KCl precipitate, and we'd still have the same concentration of chloride. So it kept constant, and that was our trick. Then we found out that it wasn't all that tricky because we didn't really need a saturated solution. We could just have a high concentration, and things didn't change much. But that was a reference electrode. Now it's an indicator electrode. So I don't want to control the chloride content. I just want to measure the chloride content. So I stick my electrode, like the one I showed you, this one, into a beaker, and it responds to any chloride ions that are present in the system. So these chloride ions are interacting with that AgCl coating that I drew on there, that I squiggled on the surface of that silver wire. And this reaction is occurring, and the Nernst equation tells us what the potential is that will develop at the surface of that electrode, and we're using it as an indicator. And it's an electrode of the second kind, because the first kind was just a piece of silver. Now we added chloride to it to make a chloride electrode. Okay, we all clear with that? Everybody's happy, excited, can't wait to get out of class. All right. What else can I tell you? The third, you can make an electrode of the third kind. This is not the electrode of the third kind. So that was, did I say that here somewhere? I don't know if I did. Yeah, there it is. This is the electrode of the second kind, right? There is an electrode of the third kind. Now, I told you that this is nomenclature that is obsolete. But you go into books and it's still there, right? So so I just want to make you aware of, if you see an electrode of the first kind, what are they talking about? Electrode of the second kind, well, you have an understanding. If I have silver in contact, silver by itself, it's electrode of the first kind. Silver in contact with its insoluble precipitate, electrode of the second kind. All I've got to do is come up with something that reacts with chloride. Let's say lead. Okay, lead ions, Pb2 plus, will react with chloride to form a complex, to form a lead or an ion pair or whatever your inorganic chemistry tells you that it is. Okay, you can think of it however you want. So now I have lead. Let's say I have a solution, and it has lead in the solution. I have lead in the solution. I want to measure the lead ions. Well, I could measure them with a silver chloride system. If I put a little bit of chloride ions in the solution, the lead reacts with the chloride. The chloride is measured by the chloride electrode. And now I've got an electrode for lead, but we call it an electrode of the third kind, because now we're, three steps removed? Or we have three mechanisms going on here. We have silver chloride, and then lead reacting with the chloride. So electrochemists, they must have been chemists with a budget, okay? That they did everything on the cheap, and they came up with these clever systems in order to measure various ions. And we'll see later on that they did some other clever things. Again, very inexpensive, very rudimentary, primitive, but they did them in order to make these measurements, and the theory holds up pretty well. In practice, they don't work all that well. That's not a good way to measure lead. It's not even really a good way to measure chloride, and it's definitely not a good way to measure silver, but it does work. Okay, it works for all of those things. So there is such a thing as an electrode of the third kind as well. Now, here's where my other scheme of categorizing these electrodes departs a little bit, and that is we now are going to mention a third type of metallic electrode, and that is the inert electrode. And the inert electrode, and I scavenged through my lab this morning and I couldn't find one, but we do have one down there, and maybe I'll bring it in if I find it. All it is a piece of platinum. So it could be a platinum wire. It could be a platinum disc, and the one I have downstairs. I actually have a couple of them. Platinum disc electrode is just a shiny platinum disc. Probably somebody stole it and had it made into jewelry. Okay, but they didn't know that the platinum crucibles are worth far more than the platinum electrode. But at any rate, a lot more platinum than the crucible. The situation is that this is an inert system. You stick it into a solution, absolutely nothing happens. But if you have some chemistry that you're performing in that solution, for example, you're doing a redox titration. Redox titration. The classic redox titration for the undergraduates is iron 2, iron 3 system being oxidized by permanganate. So you titrate, you have a system of iron 2, and you're titrating with a beautiful purple permanganate solution, and we're oxidizing the iron 2 to iron 3, and the permanganate is being reduced to ugly manganese dioxide. And how do you monitor that? You monitor it with an inert electrode. You stick a couple of platinum electrodes into the system, and you can. And what do? It says on here they act as a source or a sink for electrons. So you can actually monitor the redox reaction that you're doing by sticking in these inert electrodes and measuring the potential change that occurs because of this redox titration. Now, you say, is that used at all? It is used in some very specific applications. I worked for Bristol-Myers, and we did certain of the finished products that we were making, penicillin and penicillin substitutes, D-cillin K and these other antibiotics. And they would send them samples of the finished product, the finished material, to the lab for quality control purposes. And we did a non-aqueous, we actually did the titration in acetic acid, okay, 100% acetic acid. We dissolved the V-cillin K and 100% acetic acid, and we do a redox titration, monitored by two platinum electrodes, and get a nice titration curve and be able to determine the actual concentration of the material based on that redox titration. So it is used in some applications, and even the classic Carl Fischer titration is a redox titration. I don't know, people don't like to do that anymore because of the pyridine, and so they've come up with substitutes, and I'm not that familiar with what those are. But at any rate, this is a third type of electrode, metallic. It still falls under the metallic category. It's typically platinum or gold, and it's just a source or sink for electrons. It is not undergoing any kind of a chemical reaction like the other species that we talked about, or the systems that we talked about. Okay, let me just give you a quick summary then. Summary of metallic electrodes, important historically for the development of potentiometric sensors. Okay, a lot of current research on sensors. Okay, you go to NSF or to various government agencies that are giving out money, and there's money earmarked for sensor development. Okay. We're in a stage in chemical research and development where we want to develop new sensors. Why? Because we have computers that can take large amounts of information. The more information we have, maybe the better we're able to make decisions. So they want to make sensors. Electrochemical sensors are a big part of that. And what I told you about reference electrodes, very important. Indicator electrodes we're building to get to the more useful indicator electrodes that we're going to find in use every day in the laboratory. So they're not very practical in modern electrochemical systems, primarily, and I didn't mention this, but primarily because of their poor detection limits. Silver ion system, lousy. Worked fine in the 0.1 molar level, okay? But at the part per million or micromolar level, forget about it. You won't see anything. Inert electrodes we just mentioned for redox titrations. There are better systems available for chloride, and we'll talk about them. And I mentioned the electrode of the third kind already, and so we can move on. Do you have anybody have any questions about any of that stuff? Okay. So we're going to move on to membrane electrodes. We're going to talk about at least four or five different types of membrane electrodes. I listed four of them here. There's the glass membrane electrode. It's an old pH electrode. This is old, so let me tell you, this is old. Everybody's made pH measurements. Everybody makes pH measurements every day. People screw it up every day, okay? They make mistakes. And so we're going to clarify. Remember, one of the themes I have here is, as an analytical chemist, or as a person studying analytical chemistry, you need to understand the theory, principle behind these measurements so that you don't make mistakes in making these measurements. And pH, they said, oh, anybody can measure pH. I mean, they even have pocket pH meters. I won one at a conference once, at a Pittsburgh conference or someplace. And I won one of these at the pH electrode, but I don't have it anymore. But it was a pocket, you know, it looked like a pen. You pull it out and you could measure the pH of your coffee. I guess this is, you know, good for conversation at cocktail parties or something. My coffee is pH 2. That can't be good for me. It's not. You don't see me drinking that stuff. Okay, so glass membrane electrodes are the most important type of membrane electrode. There's also solid-state membrane electrodes for ion-selected electrode measurements like chloride. We'll talk about that, or other things, lead, copper, cadmium, a whole bunch of solid-state electrodes. The membrane is a solid-state crystal, right, compared to a piece of glass as a membrane. Then there are liquid junction membrane electrodes. We'll talk about how they work. There are gas-permeable or permeable membrane electrodes, a very, very important class of indicator electrodes are membrane electrodes, and we're going to start out with the pH electrode or the glass electrode for pH measurements. This lovely antique okay, pH electrode. I love it because it has a blue tip, right? And this is the sensing part of the electrode. It's all made of glass, but only the tip, the blue part, is actually the membrane which develops a potential when you put it into a solution, and protons cause the potential to develop. So we have a glass membrane. It's very thin. Maybe you've broken one. Okay, my students break them every day, I think, because we have more broken electrodes than we have ones that work. But at any rate, it's a fairly thin glass membrane, and I have a little very crude schematic here that says, okay, what I have is a piece of glass, and inside there's a solution. And you can probably see that there's a solution inside. That solution is an acid solution. Of course, all aqueous solutions will have some protons in them. And so there's an internal solution, and it has some concentration of protons, or some activity, as indicated by the A here. And then we're putting it into a solution that we want to measure the pH of. So that's on the outside of the piece of glass, or the glass membrane. And that's my test solution that has some activity also. A potential develops across the membrane. Why is that? Well, because it's a, we'll talk a little bit about the structure of glass, silicon dioxide, but it is a coherent piece of material. What you do on the inside has some influence on what happens on the outside. Okay? The chemistry of what is going on the inside influences what's on the outside and vice versa. And so if I put a lot of protons on the outside of the solution over here, so let's say I put it in, you know, pH equals 1 solution, right? Then that is going to influence the protons that are on the inside of the glass surface. Now, let's see if I have a diagram. There it is. Stolen from the internet, silicon dioxide, okay? This is the structure of glass. Glass is silicon dioxide. I said, oh, I thought silicon dioxide was beach sand. It is. That's where they get it. So we've got silicon atoms, like carbon, 4 bonds, 4 oxygens around each silicon. In glass, or in silicon dioxide, their adjacent silicons are sharing an oxygen, right? So that's how we end up with SiO2 instead of SiO4. But at any rate, in a glass matrix, okay, it's this repeating silicon, oxygen, silicon, oxygen. Okay, three-dimensional structure. Now, it's in 2 dimensions here, but you can imagine that on the back side of each of those silicons is another oxygen, or more silicons and so forth. And so we have, they're tetrahedral, right? They're tetrahedral. It's not really planar the way it's laid out here. This is squashed into a planar format. And really, they're tetrahedral structures. So every silicon is attached to 4 oxygens, but it's sharing them with other silicons. So my overall structure, or my overall stoichiometry, is silicon dioxide, silicon with 2 oxygens. Now, let's see what I have on my next slide. Okay, so I told you that I have a test solution, which maybe it's pH 1. And then I have an internal solution, and typically the internal solution is like 0.1 molar HCl. Whatever happens on the outside is going to affect what goes on the inside. So in this little diagram, in this little picture, at the end of the matrix, the glass has some thickness, right? That little thin membrane has some thickness, some microns thick, right? And at the so there's a layer of glass with its three-dimensional silicon oxygen structure. But then at the surface, what happens at the surface? The matrix of repeating silicon oxygen ends, and what do we have? We have OHs, okay? Or silanol groups. And the silanol groups are actually acidic, or have some acidity. I forget what the pKa is. Might be 5.5, but I could be wrong about that. And so some of the of those silanol groups will deprotonate and leave me with an O minus, for an SiO minus, right? So we're going to have some OHs and some O minuses. When I, now remember, this is a piece of glass, and let's say this is the outside. Outside. I guess a better way to say that is the external. Okay? The external part of the glass, the part that's going to be dipped into a test solution. And then the other side of this membrane, so this is my membrane, and then this would be the internal. Okay, and it's got, what did we say, 0.1 molar HCl. And this has got, you know, OHs, what's an H? Maybe an O minus, okay? So, I put it into an acidic solution. I said it was pH 1. What happens? Hydrogen ions, there's too many to number in pH 1, okay? pH 1, 0.1 molar, whatever the acid is. And we've got lots of hydrogen ions. And they're protonating most, or maybe 99.9% or whatever, you can do the calculation, of all of these silanol groups. Now these are all protonated already, but maybe I gotta protonate these, okay? The fact that protons are jumping on to the external sites of those silanol groups because of the exposure to an acid solution, then internally, in the internal solution, we may have some protons coming off, okay, H plus. We may have some protons going on, but remember my premise that what goes on the outside is going to influence what goes on the inside. Inside of my electrode, or inside of my filling solution and so forth, and you can't see it, that's one thing I don't like about this electrode, is that you can't see what's up in here. But up in here is a piece of silver wire coated with some silver chloride, okay, and in contact with the internal filling solution, the 0.1 molar HCl. And of course, there's silver in that system as well, actually silver chloride, silver and silver chloride. And so this electrode is no different than the electrodes that we've talked about before, and that piece of wire, silver chloride wire, you can play with that if you want, responds or changes potential depending on what is going on with that membrane, what the acidity on the outside of the electrode is, what the acidity on the inside is, which we fix, but it responds to what's going on the outside of that membrane. It gives a slight potential change. Now you say, okay, so write me the reaction. I can't. Okay, it's not a defined chemical reaction like silver plus an electron gives you silver metal, silver ion plus an electron, or silver chloride, AgCl plus an electron gives you silver metal and a chloride ion. You can't write a reaction for glass the same way that you can for some other well-defined species. What we have is sort of an empirical system, or a system that, and again, chemists are probably pretty bad at describing interfacial phenomenon or reactions that occur between solutions and solids. Our ability to do things that are in homogeneous systems is probably pretty good. Our ability to describe things that go on in a system like that that's heterogeneous, glass, you know, solution surface, is probably pretty poor. What do we do? Well, I said it's empirical. We can make an empirical relationship that describes what goes on in the system. So, remember the Nernst equation? Well, this sort of looks a little bit like the Nernst equation. It has an E. Instead of an E0, there's a K, because we don't have an E0 for glass. There is no standard potential for glass. So we'll just say, okay, there's some constant in there. It still has the 0.0591. N equals 1 because H plus is monovalent, so there's a 1 under here. And it's LOG, activities as we described previously. And let's see, A2 was the fixed concentration of 0.1 molar HCl. So I take my Nernst equation, and I'm going to use it for pH electrodes, but again, it's sort of an empirical situation. I don't have an E0, I don't have the defined reaction. I do know that the chemical species is H plus that I'm concerned with. I am going to incorporate the concentration on the internal, the fixed solution that's inside of that electrode, which I called A2 in my scheme here. I'm going to incorporate that into the K. So I'm going to go over here, and I'm going to call it K prime. I had a K, now I call it K prime. I got rid of the A2 in the denominator, and now I just have A1. So the system turns out to be fairly simple. I have E that I measure. It's going to change in response to the activity of the test solution. I am going to have two constants in my system, or we'll call them constants, or for the sake of argument right now. One of them is 0.0591, and the other is K prime. Okay. Now, since I have this as log, and this is positive, and we know the definition of pH is negative log of the hydrogen ion activity, I incorporate that. I put pH here. This becomes a negative sign, and E is now proportional. E is now equal to K prime minus 0.0591 times the pH. So we have, again, developed an empirical system for determining pH, hydrogen ion activity, based on a potentiometric system. There's the electrode with the blue tip, okay? Glass pH electrode, I already mentioned to you how it's constructed. Got electrical contact, some kind of a seal, a glass body. It has a 0.1 molar HCl filling solution. That's almost universal. It does have a silver wire coming down here with a silver coating on the end, okay? Thin glass membrane, it's always blue. No, I'm just kidding. And it works, okay? It works. You have to use it with a reference electrode, so we can't use it by itself. It's got to have a reference. That's just the indicator portion. We do need a millivoltmeter, electrometer, and we do need a reference electrode. So we've got to have all those things. It's a half cell. The half cell voltage is proportional to pH. It has what's called Nernstian slope. What's Nernstian slope? 0.0591. Okay, Nernst came up with it. We'll give him his credit here. It's Nernstian slope. Now, the intercept is K. So, in other words, if I have a plot, I'll show you some plots in a minute, but it's millivolts versus pH, okay? And so I'm going to get some response in my millivolts, and it's actually going to have a negative slope based on the negative sign. And so whatever my pH is, I'm going to see a change in the millivolt reading, and the slope of that is going to, in theory, be 0.0591, okay? And the intercept, okay, the y-intercept is going to be K prime, okay? And let's see, what do I have next? Ah, I have a picture of a pH meter. And this is where I digress a little and talk about ways in which people screw up pH measurements. Oh, we got lots of time. Lots. Okay, so what do I got? I got a simple, very basic pH meter. And it says on the front of the meter there are three controls. This, of course, just tells you what mode you're in. So this happens to be set at pH to the 0.001 units, so we're going to be able to measure thousandths of a pH unit, okay, all the way down to this decimal place. And then we have a calibration knob, and then we have another control over here. And you said, oh, that looks like it's two controls. It has temperature and slope. Well, in reality, this little knob right here does all the work. And this dial around the outside is useless. It doesn't do anything. Okay? It's just junk. It's just something for you to play with. You know how people like to chew their fingernails or stuff like that? That's all it's for. It has absolutely no purpose in life. Well, that's not true. That's not true. It does have a purpose. It does relate slope and temperature. Because remember that in our Nernst equation, RT over NF, this, you know, we converted RT over NF natural log to 0.0591 over N times base 10 log, right? This is what we called our slope. Well, it has temperature in it. Okay? So slope and temperature relate or change together. Right? They're directly proportional. So when I say this knob, it doesn't do anything. It doesn't do anything to the meter. It does tell you that whatever I'm set on, whatever this dial ends up being set on, it tells you at that temperature what your slope reading, how close it is to the Nernstian value. Now, here's what happens. If you go to Fisher Scientific, you open up a Fisher Scientific catalog. Does anybody do that anymore? We do in our lab still. But you go online and you buy a pH electrode for Fisher. You could spend $300 for a nice quality electrode, and they'll tell you gives 100% of Nernstian slope. In other words, when I plot millivolts versus pH, okay, I'm going to get a slope that is negative 0.0591, 100%. It's going to give me that slope. I spent a lot of money. I paid $300 for this electrode. It better give me the 100%. Now, you can go down on Middlesex Street, and there's a guy with a raincoat. He opens up his raincoat. He's got pH meters in there. Well, anyway, pH electrodes, okay? You could buy one for $50, okay? It's not going to give you 100% Nernstian slope. It might give you 90% Nernstian slope, 85%. The electrodes that we buy for the freshman laboratory, you know, there are 350 students taking freshman chemistry, and they break things every day, and we don't buy the $300 electrodes for the freshman lab. We buy the, you go down to Middlesex Street, you buy the, anyway. Okay, so the point is that this outer ring does is relate temperature and slope, but it's not controlling the meter at all. Like I said, it's a useless dial. It just spins around on the outside. And if you didn't know what the temperature and the slope, how they related, we know theoretically how they're supposed to relate. All it's telling you is that it's 25 degrees in the lab, and the slope is reading 100%. Hey, I got my money's worth. Or the slope is reading, as this one is, 98%, roughly, 98%. And the temperature in the lab probably is about 22 or 23 degrees, which is more common to what the lab temperature is. 25 is a little warm. And it's okay. Everything's cool. If it was way off, then I might be concerned. I might be concerned that my electrode is dying, okay, that it's not responding properly. Okay. I went through all of that, but really what I wanted to point out to you is there are two controls. One is the calibration control, the other one is the slope control. That would make sense because when I relate my empirical equation that we just developed, E to pH, I've got a slope that I got to worry about, and I've got a intercept that I have to worry about. And I showed you how that relates on this diagram. I've got a slope, and I've got an intercept, and I want to measure that by measuring millivolts. And I want to know what the pH is. So I do it, and I'm going to use these two knobs to calibrate the system. Okay, proper pH calibration. People do this wrong every day, and so I'm going to tell you how to do it right. Some clever electrical engineers have built us electrometers that have this equation built in to this device. Okay, the equation is built in there. How they get the equation inside of there, I don't know. But anyway, it's in there. And it measures potential versus pH, but we got to calibrate it. The way we do that is we start with a pH 7 buffer. You must start with a pH 7 buffer. I'm tempted to have you repeat after me, but that's sort of like second grade. So, but anyway, you must start with a pH 7 buffer. The reason is because the clever electrical engineers that made the meter for us, they built the equation into the meter such that the line pivots around pH 7. Okay, now this will become a little bit clearer as I go along. But their calibration line inside the meter that you're going to adjust by the calibration and slope controls, it pivots around pH 7. And all meters are set up that way. Now, you could change it if you wanted to, or in very, 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 very rare cases, so rare that I've never seen one, you could have a meter that has a different potential at which the line pivots, but every meter that I ever heard of is pivots around a pH 7. That is referred to as the isopotential. I don't know if it's on yours or on here. You're supposed to read the slides. I don't know. It's called the isopotential. It stays the same, and you must calibrate that pH first. Otherwise, you're doing it wrong. You have the possibility that if you aren't careful, you'll get an incorrect calibration. And so I'm telling you, the first step in calibrating a pH meter is to use a buffer that is pH 7. All right? And when you use the pH 7 buffer, you're going to adjust this control right here, the calibration control, and you're going to turn that until the pH reads 7.000. That's easy to do, huh? Just change it. So let's see what it says. It has two controls, calibrate and slope. Use the pH 7 buffer, adjust the calibrate knob. Now, what it's doing is, since that line pivots around 7, if you change the slope of the line, 7 doesn't change, right? Because it pivots around 7. So I do 7, I use the pH 7 buffer first, and I change the calibration knob, and all it does is change the position of that 7, or essentially it's helping you to fix the intercept. Okay? So the line moves up and down, okay, when I change the calibration knob, and it's I'm going to get the 7 point exactly where it belongs, and when I change the slope, it won't matter. Because the 7 won't, it pivots around 7, the meter pivots around 7, and it won't change that. Then the second step in proper pH calibration is to use a buffer, any other buffer than 7. Don't use 7. You can't use 7 twice, okay? Won't help you any. You need something to allow you to change that slope. It's best from an analytical perspective. Analytical chemists like to bracket their samples with standards. The buffers are your standards. If you're going to measure the pH of the Merrimack River, it's a little less than 7. So you might go out and get a pH 4 buffer, or a pH 5 buffer, or a pH 6 buffer, and combine that with a 7. Do your 7 first, change the calibration knob, then put the other buffer in there, rinse off the electrode thoroughly to get the pH 7 buffer off of it, put it into your other electrode, let's say it's a pH 5 buffer, and adjust the slope knob, okay? Change the slope control on the pH meter, and that will pivot the line to get the proper slope. It won't change the 7 because it's pivoting around the 7. You do that, your pH electrode is calibrated with a 2-point calibration. Now, it does say isopotential on this slide, and some of the stuff that I already told you. Okay, so you could do a 2-point calibration, pH 7 and some other pH. You could do a 3-point calibration. A lot of people do 4, 7, and 10. If you don't do the right one first, and you only do a 2-point calibration curve, you could be all wrong, right? If you adjust, this doesn't say, but let's say I put in pH 5 buffer, and I control the calibration knob, and then I put in the pH 7 buffer, and I try to change the slope, this thing is all whacked out, okay? And so I probably got the slope wrong initially, and then I got the calibration right with the pH 7, and the meter is going to read fine at pH 7, but it's going to be wrong at the other pHs. Okay? So this is a problem, and people do it wrong all the time, and now you know why you have to use a pH 7, because of that isopotential. And actually, if you look on the back of the meter, the back of the meter probably will have an adjustment to change that isopotential. Okay. I already mentioned the slope comes from RTNF. That's the Nernstein value. The slope is temperature sensitive, okay? And so T is part of the 0.0591. So you do have to be concerned about the temperature. And if typical situation for analytical chemists is all that theory about the Nernst equation, well, we never use the Nernst equation when we measure pH, right? We just throw the electrode into our beaker and adjust the knobs, right? Well, first we do our pH 7, then we do our pH 4 or 5 or whatever, and get our calibration and then put it in a test solution, and away we go. We don't care about the Nernst equation or any of that stuff. That's correct. We're using calibration. We're using standards to calibrate, and that's fine. But we do need to be concerned that we're doing the calibration correctly. Then we need to be concerned that all the standards and the test solutions are at the same temperature. Otherwise, the slope is going to be off, right? The T in the 0.059 from the Nernst equation is going to give me an improper response if temperature is not controlled or constant in some way. Other factors that influence the slope, it says here, impurities in the glass. That's how we get less than 100% Nernstein response, because the guy down on Middlesex Street is making them out of cheap glass. Okay, and other aspects of the electrode quality, right? And again, you pay for good quality usually. You can also pay sometimes for not good quality. Full Nernstein response, 100%. Partial Nernstein response, maybe 90%. And they tell you this right in the Fisher catalog. Oh, this will give, you know, 95%, 90%, whatever. This part of my slide gives you the classical shorthand representation that electrochemists use to show what how an electrochemical cell is put together. A single line represents a phase boundary, two phases. Okay, so what do we got? We got a silver phase and we got a silver chloride phase. That silver wire with silver chloride on the outside of it is two separate phases in contact with one another. So we have a single line separating them in this shorthand notation. Notice that there's little subscript S's there to indicate solids. So it's silver wire, which is a solid, and silver chloride, which is a solid. And then that's in contact with aqueous chloride concentration. If this is the reference electrode, which it is, okay, then that reference electrode has a controlled chloride concentration because we put saturated KCl in there or something to control that chloride concentration. So there's a phase boundary there as well. Then we have a double line to indicate the either a salt bridge or a junction between two solutions. And here we have our reference electrode in contact with our unknown test solution, our test solution of an unknown concentration. So there's a double line. That is also has a double line separating it from the glass electrode, which has 0.1 molar HCl in it. It has silver chloride and silver in it. The system is saturated with silver chloride. Technically, all of these systems are saturated with silver chloride. In other words, once I put insoluble AgCl in contact with any solution and let it come to equilibrium, it's saturated with silver chloride. Right? Silver chloride is an insoluble material. It has a very, very small solubility, and so it dissolves a little bit in the system. And that's my shorthand notation, just for, I don't know, future reference. Okay, let me quickly mention errors in pH measurement. There are many errors. I already mentioned some of them to you. pH measurements are only good as the buffers that are used to calibrate the systems. your typical buffers that you buy are only good to plus or minus 0.01 pH units. But you told us we could make measurements to a thousandth of a pH unit. All right, I lied. Okay, you can't make accurate measurements unless you do several things. I'll explain those several things as we go along. But if you buy the buffer solution from Fisher Scientific or BWR or whoever you buy it from, it'll say right on it, plus or minus 0.01, okay, at 25 degrees C, whatever. So making measurements to 0.001, you have no accuracy. You have absolutely no idea what that third place means. In terms of accuracy, you understand the difference between accuracy and precision? Okay. Accuracy, you have no idea. Now, can you get accurate measurements to a thousandth of a pH unit? You can. You have to spend a lot of money for National Institute of Standards and Technology certified buffers, or buffers that are traceable to NIST. In other words, they bought the buffer and said their buffer is as good as, or is, gives a value equal to or within some error of that NIST value. It is possible, but there's a lot of other problems as well. And I'll go into them as we go along. Precision, on the other hand, you can get good precision down to plus or minus 0.01 units. For example, there's my meter. If that number is constant, and it doesn't change, it's not going up or going down, okay? I know that when I make measurements of various solutions, that and they come out the same all the time, I've got really good precision, okay? But this number, I can't report it because I don't know what it is, because my buffer is not good enough to calibrate at the thousandth of a pH unit. Does that make sense? Accuracy is not is only good to a hundredth of a pH unit, typically because of buffers. Precision, okay, the ability to repeat that measurement can be done at the thousandth of a pH unit. All right, so errors in pH measurement, accuracy, precision. I mentioned previously junction potential. Junction potential depends on ionic strength of the solution, and if I have, if my filling solution, let's say my reference electrode, has 4 molar potassium chloride in it, and it typically will, and I'm measuring a dilute solution, there's a big junction potential between 4 molar potassium chloride and whatever you're measuring, some dilute solution. Unless you're measuring the pH of 4 molar potassium chloride, you're going to have some junction potential. And so I have to remember that it matters that I have a junction potential. Now, how do I correct for it? Well, the easiest way to correct for it is to minimize it by calibrating at the same or similar ionic strength as my sample. So if I'm measuring high ionic strength samples like seawater or, bodily fluids of some kind or, brines of some sort, I want to have buffers that have a similar ionic strength to the solution that I'm measuring. If I measure really dilute solutions, I want to have dilute buffers. And so, and what's going to happen is the junction potential will be similar in my standard measurement and in my test measurement, and therefore it will negate itself, okay? It will cancel itself out. That's really the only way to handle a junction potential, right? This must be my cue to tell you that the reason that you can't make, or in order to make good precise measurements at thousandths of a pH unit, you need a Faraday cage. You know what a Faraday cage is? I've seen some really hokey Faraday cages. You basically take your pH meter, and it's got to be inside of a metal box or a metal mesh, wire mesh that's grounded. Why? because surrounding us, you can't see it, but there are all sorts of electrical or electromagnetic radiation, right? Radio waves, right? Telephone waves, you know, everything's electronic today, right? Beepers, even the air conditioners have remote controls, okay? So there's radio waves all around us. When you make a measurement of the pH in the laboratory, this wire acts like an antenna. As a matter of fact, in the wintertime, particularly when you have static electricity, you put your hand near the wire, the pH will change. That's not good, okay? So we put a Faraday cage around it and ground that. So we take a metal cage around the pH meter and electrode and everything and ground it to Earth, and that will prevent those interferences. Okay, if there's a nuclear attack, it won't affect your pH measurements, all right? Never mind. So you need a Faraday cage. You also need temperature control. You may need to use a vessel that has a water jacket that's controlled by a constant temperature bath to keep the temperature at a fixed value. Because if the temperature changes by even 1 degree, okay, it will alter the slope of the Nernstein response, and you get an error. And that'll really throw off the thousandths unit in your pH measurement. This time of year, what happens? You wake up in the morning, it's cold. Temperature increases all day long till around noon, mid-afternoon, then it starts to drop again. Right? Temperature's changing. And in this building, the temperature that we feel today is whatever it was last night, okay? Because that's the way it works. So temperature's changing, and you have to control the temperature. And again, you have to buy those special buffers. So in order to make really accurate measurements, you have to do all these things. Do you really care? Most of the time, people don't care. Probably for most of the measurements that we make, a measurement of a plus or minus a tenth of a pH unit would be good enough. Okay. When you get into doing titrations, potentiometric titrations, things like that, you make specialized measurements of pKa values and so forth, you need good control. But for the average person, they just want to know, how, you know, is it pH 5 or is it pH 6? You know, is it 5.9 or 6.1? Okay. We can do that easily with the standard materials that we have if we do things properly through calibration, control the temperature a little bit, make sure everything's at the same temperature and so forth. Okay, errors in pH measurement. There is something known as the asymmetry potential. When you take this electrode and it has 0.1 molar HCl inside of it. If you put it into a solution of 0.1 molar HCl, the same solution is on the inside and the outside. There should be no potential developed across the glass membrane, in theory. But in reality, there is a potential that develops across the membrane. Why? We can give you some answers. We can give you some possibilities. It says on the slide, does it say on the slide? Oh, yeah, strain in the glass. Well, if you ever done any glass blowing in the lab next door, well, it's 2 doors down, and you make a piece of you heat up some glass and you make a nice little bubble like this. Okay, if you don't carefully anneal the glass, when you're done, it cracks. Why does it crack? Strain in the glass. Okay, so if there's potentially strain, in other words, forces in the glass, that they manifest themselves, those forces of the glass structure being strained, may manifest themselves as a potential that develops across the membrane even when the exact same solution is on the inside and the outside. What do you do about it? Buy quality electrodes. Okay, if you want to minimize the asymmetry potential, about the only thing you can do is buy a high-quality electrode that's been annealed properly when they made the glass bulb and prepared the electrodes. They put them in an annealing oven and cool them from the molten glass temperature to room temperature very slowly, allowing the glass molecules, the silicon dioxide, to properly align itself and produce the minimum strain. There's always some strain. EA is another non-ideal potential, just like EJ, that affects our overall cell. We don't know always what they are, we just try to minimize them, okay? So that's asymmetry potential. Temperature of electrodes, I mentioned this already. Calibration must be done at the same temperature, primarily because of the T in the Nernst equation. There's something referred to as a ATC probe, automatic temperature compensation probe. You can connect that to some meters, allow you to connect that. It's a second probe. You get your pH electrode, which actually is two probes in one, right? It's a reference and a pH. You put it in the solution with this ATC probe. It compensates for T in the Nernst equation, right? It compensates for the slope change. There's something called alkaline error or sodium error. Actually, these are two separate things. They're not. Alkaline error is sodium error. Acid error is the other one. That's probably on recording. Okay. So, alkaline error. I'll tell you about acid error. Alkaline error. Okay, what happens? I put my electrode in a very high pH solution, very alkaline solution. How do I get that alkaline solution? I dump a whole bunch of sodium hydroxide into an aqueous solution, okay? And I get a pH of, 12, okay? So pH of 12. The solution is loaded with sodium ions, all right? It's loaded with sodium ions, 0.01 molar sodium to get pH 12. I've got hydrogen ion activity of 10 to the minus 12th molar. 10 to the minus 12th, what is that? Picomolar? Nanomolar, picomolar? Picomolar. There is 10 orders of magnitude difference between my hydrogen ion concentration and my sodium ion concentration. The sodiums outnumber the hydrogens 10 billion to 1. I mean, these are starting to get to be big numbers, 10 billion. The electrode, that scheme that I showed you with the silicon dioxide matrix and the silanol groups and little hydrogens coming off and hydrogens coming back on, well, guess what? When you have 10 billion sodium ions for every hydrogen ions, okay, the hydrogen ions are a little bit intimidated, okay? They're scared. They're running scared, okay? There's a big gang of sodium out there, okay? And so the sodium, what happens is the sodium plugs up those negatively charged sites on the surface of the glass, and the electrode begins to respond to sodium. Now, it doesn't. The glass membrane has been selected for its response to hydrogen ion, and it does respond better to hydrogen ion than to sodium ion. But 10 billion, I mean, come on, you know, this is a big, you know, this is unfair. I mean, these odds are unfair. And so what happens is the electrode begins to respond a little bit to sodium, but there's so much extra sodium that little bit of response to sodium begins to cause an error in your hydrogen ion measurements. That error doesn't become important until you get to the high pH, and I checked. And I don't have the slide. I'll show you the slide next class. But what happens is you find there's no error in the middle of the range caused by this. So in pH, 9, not a problem. pH 8, not a problem. Still more sodium there than there is hydrogen ion if you made up the solution with sodium hydroxide. But when you get up to pH 10, depending on where you got your electrode, Middlesex Street, Fisher Scientific, whatever, then you are going to begin to see an error. And if it's a cheap electrode that was constructed poorly and the glass was not very selective for hydrogen ions, then it will begin to respond to sodium, and you'll see a large error as you get into the pH 11, 12, and so forth pH range. If it's a good glass, good electrode, you won't see a large error. That is the sodium error or alkaline error problem. And it's a significant problem. It's a significant problem. You think you're measuring, you can't understand, you could be off by an order of magnitude. okay, in terms of your hydrogen ion concentration, just because sodium is responding. Now, the same thing happens on the other end of the scale. Okay, to make a system acidic, I got to dump in a lot of acid. That acid has with it other ions that influence the response of the electrode. It's not quite as well defined as the sodium error, but it has the same effect. At very, very low pHs, the electrode doesn't respond quite as well to hydrogen ion. In the middle of the range, no problem. And some manufacturers will tell you, we've got a really good electrode. You're going to pay for it, but we got a really good electrode, okay? Its response will go from, you know, pH 1 to pH 13 without any significant error. So, you know, again, you shell out the $300, you buy a good pH electrode. You spend 50 bucks, okay, you're going to get a really bad alkaline error, more than likely, and a pretty bad acid error also. I will continue on Wednesday with and finish up pH membrane electrodes, and we'll move on to other membrane electrodes as well. Okay? If you have any questions, let me know. And I should be up to speed on the website and get all this information up there for you so you can